From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in the not-too-distant future, in your dating life. Now, I don't mean to trigger any unpleasant memories, and if you're single, if you're in the dating world, I know it can be not a whole lot of fun. It's hard to meet people, can be very, very frustrating. Maybe you're thinking you're glad to be done with the dating world. But there's something interesting happening here. New research indicating that maybe we can pick our partners better. Maybe we can figure out a different way so we're not setting ourselves up for future disappointment or heartache. Writing for Inverse.com, Hannah Lee says, a dystopian love simulation could prove that you're with the right person. She writes, quote, imagine putting your relationship into online simulated characters and seeing if those characters would end up together again or end up with someone else. Psychology researchers at the University of California, Santa Barbara are doing just that, uploading personalities and relationship decisions into simulated characters and letting them play those decisions out in a virtual world. End quote. And so I wondered, why is that dystopian? Well, it didn't take long to see the references to the show Black Mirror, a kind of science fiction horror show that looks at how technology can destroy parts of our lives. But in this case, the researchers believe they'd be doing the opposite. They think they can help couples see whether their relationship is made to last. And if it's not, are we wasting our time? The more I thought about this, the more it did seem a little bit beyond the gentle banality of something like Match.com. This is a simulation that seems to be, well, taking the work out of relationship building, and I'm sure I'm seeing something wrong here. But aren't human beings always changing? How could I know whether a new girlfriend is going to be an ideal lifelong partner for me? I'm not static. She's not static. But this research claims to be able to account for some important foundational issues that can threaten relationships or make them stronger. 40 to 50% of the time, the in-real-life couples ended up as couples in the simulated world in this research. That also meant, by the way, about 50% of the time, couples do not match back up. And that might be terrifying for us. Think about if you're in a relationship and you put yourself in a simulation like this. Would it work out? As Hannah Lee writes, exactly why we're seeing only half work out is at the heart of the new research. And in the future, this information could be used to help people build happier relationships. So would you sign up for this? Would you look at a new partner and say, sorry, it says we're going to crash and burn, so just don't call me again. Is this the future of love? Our guests this hour include an assistant professor and head of the Computational Mate Choice Lab at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Daniel Conroy Beam was on with us, and I'm grateful for your time, Daniel. Thanks for taking the time for us.
Oh, yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
Shadi Kafi is a teacher and a writer, and a former Rochesterian. Nice to have you back with us, Shadi.
Great to be here, Evan.
And Nicole Ron is a young professional, formerly from Rochester, now living in... Are you still in Nashville?
I am still in Nashville.
Now still in Nashville.
Yes.
Nicole and Shadi are two of the really interesting and funny people I know, and they've had some lucky/unlucky in love stories. And I thought they would have some really valuable insight here because they've often dealt with the frustration of trying to find partners and dealing with that dating world. But before we kind of get to their experiences, let me just ask Daniel Conroy Beam to start off by telling us, I know you've been working on this for years. Tell us how you set this up and really what the goal here is if this works out the way you want it to, Dan.
Sure. I mean, you know, the background is, you know, people have been trying to understand how people choose their romantic partners for decades. I mean, this is a big area of research with a long history. And we, you know, we had a lot of information about sort of what people think they want to do in the abstract, but not a lot of information about, you know, how those abstract ideals translate into on-the-ground choices. And so my approach to this is, you know, if we understand how this is going, we should be able to build it, right? We should be able to build a system that is able to make the same decisions that real-world people do. So that's kind of my approach, and that's sort of my goal in all of this research, right? If we really understand what's going on inside people's heads as they're choosing their romantic partners, then we should be able to build a computational system that makes the same decisions that those real people do.
And, you know, this is the kind of thing that is going to take years, I'm sure, here. But, I mean, how close are you? I mean, before I ask you if you bristle at the Black Mirror stuff, how close are you, Dan, to getting to where you want to be with this?
Oh, you know, in some ways we feel very close, but in more ways we feel very far. So, I mean, this is just the very beginning of this particular line of research. And, you know, we're excited because the initial results have been really promising, but we definitely have a long way to go. I mean, I think we're just scratching the surface here.
I mean, I talked to somebody not too long ago who said, well, this is pretty simple. In 2021, dating, especially in the United States, basically boils down to if you date somebody who votes the same way as you, you got a chance. And if you don't, like, so for example, if you're a Trump voter, you are not dating a Hillary Clinton voter. Like, that's just not going to happen, and vice versa. And everything else is noise. I mean, is that oversimplifying, or how important has your research found political alignment to be?
You know, we've just started a little bit of research looking at political alignment, among other things. And we were sort of expecting to see kind of the same thing, that people have these really hard boundaries when it comes to politics. And we're kind of not seeing a lot of evidence of that. I mean, there is, people do tend to strongly, what we call a sort, on political alignment, right? People do tend to strongly pair with people who have similar political views, but it's not clear that's because they're actively selecting people who have the same political views, or, you know, you just pick from people who are in your social circle, and your social circle has the same political views as you. So I think, you know, I think people have these ideas that they have these very hard boundaries, but if you showed them, you know, if a super attractive, super funny, super rich, super kind, you know, Republican showed up and you're a Democrat, like, I don't know that it would be as hard a boundary for you as you might think it would be.
I noticed you said super rich.
Yeah.
You're saying money can overcome political distaste.
I'm saying, you know, people have a lot of preferences that they're balancing against one another. And sometimes, you know, a negative on one dimension can be overcome by positives on others.
Now, I know you include different experiments where you ask the participants how they would describe their own long-term mate. And, you know, so you have to figure out what a person is valuing most here. How intelligent do you want a partner to be? How kind? How much of an age difference, or what their ideal age would be? How physically attractive they would rate that person? Which, by the way, there's in a lot of different ways, like, I feel like there's so many different interesting layers that I want to talk about this hour. The physical attractiveness thing is interesting because there was a news story years ago where people were asked by researchers to rate their own number of physical attractiveness on a scale of 1 to 10. And it's amazing how often whatever number you sort for yourself, you are seeking in somebody else. Is that what you found as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People tend, across dimensions, but certainly in the case of physical attractiveness, yeah, people tend to mate assortatively. They tend to pair with partners that are similar to themselves.
Okay. And when it comes to everything from religion to introversion, sociability, et cetera, was there anything that stood out as uniformly or very consistently more important than the others?
Well, so, you know, when you ask people, right, what are the things you find more important, there's pretty robust patterns that you tend to see, right? Both men and women, you know, towards the top of their wish list, kindness always appears at the top, good health, good sense of humor, intelligent, dependable. These are the things that everybody around the world pretty much says they want the most in a partner. There are some pretty reliable gender differences as well, right? Both men and women strongly desire physically attractive partners, but men emphasize it a little bit more. Both men and women want partners with good financial prospects, but women tend to emphasize it a little bit more. Men tend to like slightly younger partners than themselves. Women tend to like slightly older partners than themselves. So those are pretty robust in terms of, you know, people's subjective rankings of how important these things are. But in terms of how they translate into choices, they all kind of matter. And as far as we can tell, they seem to all matter more or less equally. We're not getting clear evidence that some of these are pulling more weight than other things.
Well, I can help you with one thing in the research there. This is where I'm sorry, but I think women should be dating men who are, let's see here. Oh, no, that does make sense, because men mature very, very slowly. So women should probably have to date men who are older, even though men don't live as long. It's a conundrum for women. Everything is real. For heterosexual women, everything is just set up against you. It's just a mess.
You know, pairing is a complicated thing.
Give me the ideally in, I'm going to give you eight or 10 more years before we've got something more commonly in use in society. What does it look like, Daniel, and kind of take me through what a simulation might be like when you've got this honed.
Well, I'm a little nervous to project that far into the future from where we're sitting right now. You know, there's lots of different routes this could go, but yeah, my maybe pie in the sky sort of best case scenario predictions. I mean, I think this is what we would like to have ideally, is a system where we can, you know, measure what you are like with some reasonable degree of accuracy. We can measure what you want with some reasonable degree of accuracy. We could do this for a large pool of interested people. We could create simulated avatars for all those people, run them through simulated mating markets, and we could give people, you know, curated lists, right? This is what the simulations say. Like, these are the people the simulations say that you're likely to have a good relationship with. And then, you know, they could choose from among those. That's the ideal scenario, and hopefully that leads to happier, more stable, more supportive relationships.
And when people say this is a, you're putting Black Mirror out into reality, what do you say to
that? I mean, I think we're not proposing, you know, this is like a government mandated system and you're like immediately married to that person that the simulation says you have to be with, right? This is going to be a noisy process, right? There's always going to be some amount of error. I think this is, we make these recommendations for people who are interested in it, and they do with that information what they want. But I think if that can help people, you know, get to good relationships faster, then I'm happy with that.
Well, I'm very curious to hear what our other guests say about these kinds of ideas and how the researcher kind of views their feedback. So, Shadi, let me start with you. You know, I let me just ask you how you view dating. Do you hate dating? Is it awful? It's awful, right?
I like to think that when I'm dating, I'm enjoying the journey, and there's an opportunity to get to learn about another person, their story, and worst case scenario, I have a hilarious story that I can share with my friend.
Yeah, I mean, like, the sad truth of that is, I mean, like, there's a lot of really nice idealistic stuff you just said, because that's how good of a person you are. But but too often it ends up with like a hilarious horror story for friends. I mean, like, that's just the world we live in. How are things for you now?
Well, I've gotten back on online dating, and things are well. Conversations are going well online. I've had a couple of dates, and so I don't know if it's because it's post, you know, people are getting out more where we are with the pandemic. But it's engaging, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's more, than it was before. I've had some luck with online dating, just meeting decent people, maybe not the right fit for me long-term, but a lot of decent people out there.
Okay. What kind of platforms have you found to be better than others?
I like The League, and I would say that it's a good one. It's linked to folks' LinkedIn, which is their professional profiles. And I've had some luck on Hinge as well. So those are the two.
The League, yep. And Hinge?
Yes.
Man, that's probably why I'm terrible at dating. I don't even know any of this stuff. where do you find it to be a terrible place to meet people?
That's a good question. It's hard to answer that, because I've had folks tell me they met their fiance on Tinder, and Tinder has the reputation of being a hookup application. I've met nice people on the dance floor. I guess the worst place is you find all kinds of people everywhere. I think worst case is probably on social media, when you have random people just kind of messaging you, mm-hmm. Direct messaging you. It can be,
men.
It feels uncomfortable.
That's,
yeah.
That is always men. That is really always men. There's certain like tests that men should be required to pass before they even get like a Twitter account. Or I mean,
yeah, I'm like, why are you messaging me? Yeah. I don't know you. This is creepy.
Yeah, I don't. Come on, guys. We can do better than that. I happen to also know that Shadi is working on a book. Can I mention this?
Sure, Evan.
Shadi is working on a book, a memoir of sorts, about her life as an Iranian American and her really just fascinating immigrant family story. And what jumps out to me in this context, Shadi, is that what you would want for yourself may not be what your parents, who've been strong influences in your life, would immediately want for you, or how they would seek to hook you up. I'm laughing thinking of vignettes from your book already. And how much has that process been, you know, you're older than you were in your teenage years, or you're even your 20s now, where you're thinking about, well, what are my parents going to say about this? What's my mom going to say about this? This is not the, you know, the blonde, safe-looking Christian boy that my mom envisioned showing up at the door and taking me out for a date, which is fascinating, by the way, for an Iranian immigrant. But how much have you been able to sort of move past what your family or your parents want and settled into a notion of what you want for yourself in a partner?
Oh, well, thank you for asking that question. My parents, you know, are different. My mom, you know, imagines the very, you know, traditional, you know, house and a husband and the kids. And I think relationships look different now. You know, people live together and they're not married. They cohabitate. Sometimes women choose to not have partners and to have kids. And I think for me, the separation from my mother's vision is now owning what I'm content with and what makes sense to me, and sort of being open to all kinds of relationships and with a partner, you know, whether he comes with having children from a previous marriage, which is fine, or if we cohabitate and we're not married, or if life creates an opportunity for me to adopt and not have a partner, but have like a really, really good, you know, friend in my life, so to speak. So I think that we're definitely moving away in general, and that's how I'm moving away from my mother's vision. And my father sort of says, you know, whatever you want, I'm happy with. He's not traditional in that sense at all. He says, you know, marriage and children is great, but you have a lot of hobbies and volunteer activities, and you work as a teacher and you give in that way. So I think as long as I, you know, am happy, he's happy for me. And if I bring home, you know, a healthy, positive individual, he'll be happy with that. So.
This is so interesting, because you are absolutely touching on a generational shift that your parents, my parents, certainly our grandparents, would not have been as comfortable or even really open to, not only everything you just mentioned, but sometimes people are comfortable with polyamory. Sometimes people are, it's very different, and it's more open and exploring and accepting. But do you think that makes it harder to use a kind of simulation to figure out who would be an ideal match for you? Or would you say, hey, this sounds very, very helpful, and this is the kind of tool you would use?
I think that we are in a time in the world where we're seeking connection in different ways. And I still very much think in-person connections are really important, and we can't let the simulation do everything for us. But at the same time, we live busy lives, and we want to connect. And so it's important to get yourself out there and connect in as many ways as is comfortable to you. And I would consider this simulation one way to get out there. I wouldn't say, you know, put all your eggs in one basket and it's like completely going to change your life and it's the best thing. But I would say it's one option of many to get yourself out there, and why not be open and try it? And chances are, if someone on the other end is open to trying this, then they have sort of a non-traditional open view, and you know, it could work out. Again, I've met people who've gotten engaged on all different types of dating applications, and I think this would be one of them to add on the list and just to try out. I wouldn't be against it.
Yeah, Daniel, I mean, do you get the sense that this that Shadi's generation, that the youngest generation of adults then is quite different than maybe our parents and grandparents, and that factors into what people are looking for or open to looking for in relationships?
Yeah, I mean, I think things are a lot more open, right? And I think there are a lot less sort of constraints on individual people, you know, expressing themselves and, you know, not necessarily adhering to, you know, certain rigid norms in all kinds of domains. So I think we're open, and I think there's definitely there's a lot more different kinds of relationships and different kinds of people who are, you know, open expressing themselves today. And I think that, you know, that does make it makes my life harder in a sense, in that there's, you know, more diversity that we have to account for, but it also makes people's lives better. And I think if we can account for that diversity, then we can, you know, optimize choice even better for individual people.
Yeah, that's very interesting. By the way, Shadi, I have two separate emails from the same listener who just wants me to know. One email says, I would never date a liberal, and the other one says, I would never date a Democrat, from the same person. So I just want you to know there are some limitations out there. Could you date somebody with a polar opposite view of politics than you, Shadi?
Thank you for that really great question. Absolutely, I would. And the reason is because I grew up with parents who are completely opposite of one another. And although they're no longer together, they had 27 great years. And I'd consider that the glass definitely half full. And I think watching these two and learning from them, I learned that you can learn so much from someone who's different from you. And if we have communication styles that we can respect, and if we can handle conflict the way we manage conflict, if it can be compatible, you know, if we can agree to disagree, why not have difficult conversations? Mm-hmm. I think that I would love someone that challenges me, that I can learn from, and how beautiful for us to get along and have some harmony through that. I don't think that people only have to be, you know, similar interests. I think at some point you're going to have something that you don't agree with, and you've got to get through that conflict. And so whether it's something as big as your political differences or as small as, you know, replacing the ring of toilet paper in the bathroom, like something very trivial, we've got to learn to get along.
Oh, I thought you were going to say something trivial there. That was a big one. I thought you were going to go trivial there. I'm with you, Shadi Kafi, and I think there is some real beauty in that sentiment from Shadi. Before I get Nicole's story, let me grab Rich in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, this is hi, Evan. How are you doing?
Good, sir.
I think this is a really good subject matter. I mean, I'm in what you would consider an unconventional relationship, long-distance, long-term relationship of over 15 years. Probably would not be easily done without today's communications, i.e. the Internet, all types of ways where you can talk and, you know, all that. But even in that situation, which I think is a great situation, there's still this pressure from people. Well, when are you going to move together? Or when are you going to get married? Or when are you going to get permanent? Like someone said to me, well, when are you going to make this permanent? And I said, I think over 15 years is pretty permanent. So it's these notions that these traditional relationships that honestly, I feel overall has been unhealthier in the sense of being forced into arranged marriages, not having sex to your, not, you know, being with someone that you must stay with regardless of how they treat you. All these traditional ideas of the permanence of a relationship and how it's supposed to be, I think overall is much less healthy than the more open, unconstrained situations that you have where people can make these decisions that are best for
them. And that's a really interesting, and I'd like to ask the researcher about that. Rich, thank you for that, because, you know, part of what Rich is talking about is just the broader experience that a lot of people have, which is that they encounter friends or family who think, well, I view the ideal relationship as XYZ, therefore you, my friend or family member, you must conform to what I think will work. And as long as we're not talking about abuse, I think we have to try to be as open as we can. Because, you know, I will say, Daniel Conroy Bean, you know, Rich is talking about his own life, long-distance relationship, and people saying, that's gone on long enough. Why don't you get married? Why don't you move closer together? it works for them. And he's saying it works for us. Why are you telling us what works for us when we say what works for us? And I think that is probably very plausible as long as both partners feel that way. I'm somebody, I cannot get my head around an open relationship. I have a hard time imagining that an open relationship is going to work for a long time. But I admit that that's a bias I have for myself. I have to try to be open to the fact that there are people who would want that and could pursue it and perhaps could make it work. So I guess it seems what I'm saying here, Dan, is that we have to understand that everybody is going to want something slightly different. And maybe that's part of the point of your simulations, is helping people find those who might have less orthodox but still viable views of what makes a relationship work. Does that make sense?
It does, and that is exactly the point, right? That's why we ask you, what is your situation? What are you like? What is it that you want? What are you looking for? And we simulate you, right, in this mating market, and we find, the best match for you in particular, right? We're not making sort of blanket suggestions like, just pick someone hot, right? We're trying to find the match that works for you in your context, right?
Yeah, and so let's get Nicole's thoughts after we take our only break, and then we're going to touch on some of the most consistent criticism of this idea that I have seen since it was first published. And we'll talk to the researcher about that. Daniel Conroy Beam is with us. He's an assistant professor and head of the Computational Mate Choice Lab at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And their research focuses on building these simulations that allows you to, it sounds very sort of techie futuristic, but you sort of plug in these ideas about how people are in relationships, you create a simulation and you see if that couple works. And what he's finding is that a lot of couples do, but a lot don't. And maybe we're not always making great choices, but his goal is to help people make better, more lasting choices in the future if that's what people want. Shadi Coffee, Nicole Ron are also with us sharing their experiences. And we'll talk to Nicole on the other side of this, our only break. Coming up in our second hour, a world-renowned maestro, a conductor who was on some of the greatest stages in classical music, and a conductor whose mental illness took him off that stage for a number of years. He is back now. He has created, along with some others, the only classical music organization in the world by and for people with mental illness. You will meet him next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Nicole Ron was a Rochesterian for some time before getting out of New York, moving to Nashville. Great timing right before a pandemic, but seems to be doing pretty well now. How are things going for you, Nicole?
Things are good. I am in a full-on relationship now, as opposed to last time I was on Connections when I was just kind of dating during a pandemic. Well, first, I'd like to say that, Shadi, I agree with pretty much everything. I agree with everything she said about dating, how choosing partners is just, like, so much more than just kind of, like, these surface level, even if it is politics, like, for sure that is important to me. But, a lot of things that seem important but in the actual realm of dating are almost surface level because there's so many intricate details that go into a connection between two people. But my boyfriend and I actually, we started dating from Tinder, but we had known each other beforehand. So it was like a misconnection that turned into, we like found each other on this app that really like this app, Tinder, to my knowledge at this point, still doesn't have any feature that puts you more with one type of person than another. It's kind of just like an open field. So it was like, the mix of two things I feel like has been important to me in online dating. Like, and I've talked to friends about this as well, where we say that we even use online dating apps to find people that we know in real life to confirm that we like are interested in each other.
Mm-hmm. Are there some better than others though? I mean, Shadi kind of talked about some that she's at least had some better experiences than others.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. And I agree with what she said as well, about just how dating in general doesn't always have to be, one perfect thing after another or like one perfect thing that lasts forever. I think learning from other people and growing from other people is one of the most important parts about dating. And as she even said, her parents were, you know, she models what she wants after what she has seen in her parents, who are not together anymore, but grew so much and so well from that experience they had together. And I think that's important too. Like, I guess measuring longevity in like a lot of senses, not just, you know, how long will this last and how perfect will it be, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, I'm also, you know, kind of struck by how when you say the purpose of dating and the approach to dating, you know, it's not always the same thing for people. Now, generally speaking, when you talk to people who are single and they are getting older, there is more pressure on dating because it feels like kind of a job interview. When you are younger, that is a little less true. But do you look at it that way, Nicole? I mean, when you've been dating, every time you're dating, are you thinking, look, I just want to have fun, I hope I meet someone cool? Or are you thinking, I am essentially interviewing a possible long-term partner here?
I go in between. And, well, the thing is, I feel like I'm at this point. I'm 29, so I never really had to think about my biological clock that much, or I didn't force myself to, and I'm still not trying to. However, that, like, yeah, the older I get, the more I kind of feel like I have to think about things. But, well, no, actually, I don't know, because I don't really feel in a rush still, I guess, no matter what. And that's just me, though, because I know a lot of people have different opinions on when they want to kind of get things moving in terms of settling down with a partner. But I don't, like, I guess I'm still along for the ride, personally.
Okay. Do you suspect if we talked 10 years from now, you'd feel the same way?
I think of myself as that. I mean, I'm in a relationship right now that I'm happy in, and I'm, of course, willing to see where that goes. And I'm not thinking of my life as a linear, like, partner up forever type of, in that way, I feel like, you know, I want to leave everything open, and I don't need to follow anything,
yep.
I guess.
Yep. And so at the age 29, this is one of the things I wanted to talk a little bit about with you, Nicole. I mean, again, I am generalizing here, but this is based on a lot of surveys, research, et cetera. You know, your generation is getting married later, having kids later or not at all, for a lot of different reasons. And one of the reasons is something we're going to talk about soon on this program with the author of a new book. Rainsford Stauffer has written about how difficult it is to find well-paying, consistent jobs, stability, etc. There's also just different cultural forces at play. So there's a lot of different reasons that people who are 29 or 27 or 32 or 25 might be thinking, I don't want to get married right now. I might never. I don't want kids right now. I might never. And how much that differs with previous generations. Do you feel like that describes you pretty well?
Yeah, it does. Well, because when you even think about it, the benefits are kind of gone at this point. Like, it's so hard to find a partner who really has health insurance. So there's not even, like, there aren't too many. Well, I feel like a lot of factors, like a lot of practical factors that I might have considered if I was in a different generation, like, they're just not relevant right now. And I'm kind of happy about that, really, because us millennials, I guess, being slightly more progressive, I think we are more in tune with our actual desires and, like, the way we want to grow with others. Not to generalize, I mean, I think any generation can, you know, have this strong awareness of what they need and what they want, but I think I'm at an age in which, like, I feel comfortable to feel that way, like, that I don't really need to partner up, I guess.
Yeah. Any pressure from your family to get married, have kids, etc.?
Not really. Like, my dad, like Shadi was saying, my dad's also very, like, as long as you're happy. I think my mother secretly judges, and, like, sometimes I want, like, she's just kind of silent, but.
She might be listening right now, Nicole.
Oh, she doesn't know how to listen to a radio that's not on her car, for sure. But, you know, like, sometimes I even will, like, I think about dating in terms of making her happy. Like, I don't do that much, but that does occur to me sometimes because I feel like she wants me to be in some kind of, like, more traditional type of love marriage situation.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. All right, two more questions before I get some feedback now from Daniel. Would you be in a long-term committed relationship with someone whose politics were the absolute opposite of yours?
Absolute opposite? I mean, I don't, you know, I would not date a Trump voter. But as Shadi said, differences, I think, are really important because my boyfriend right now, in a lot of ways, we just have a lot of points in which we argue about, but I have been experiencing a lot of growth because I feel like as people, we're always kind of self-righteous in certain ways that we might not even realize, but like, I like to be checked on things like that. You know, if I think I'm right, or if I think I'm on some moral high ground, it really helps to have someone with a different perspective kind of, you know, take apart the things I think and the ways that I just almost am lazy in my thoughts and am not progressive enough. Like, I think I would date someone super different because I am dating someone super different. Mm-hmm. And I do think there are so many benefits to just kind of conversations, and you learn more about yourself. And I think as long as the two of you, like Shadi said too, are compatible conversationally and just like in terms of understanding each other, you can actually grow a lot as a couple and learn more.
Yeah. For you, the line is Trump voter.
Totally. Yeah. Okay. Like, the line's around there. It could be way before that too. It's just definitely not that though. Yeah.
Okay. And would you sign up for the kind of simulation that Daniel Conroy Beam has been working on, that, you know, that may be more common in the future?
I mean, I don't know, because I mean, the simulation sound, it does sound a lot like that episode of Black Mirror in which like success was measured by how often the characters in that simulation rebelled together. So like that simulation is meant to be rebelled against in that specific story. And of course it's fiction. However, I think you, like, it is important to work kind of like rebellion or some kind of against all odds idea into any simulation, you know, which like Daniel, possibly, I'm sure you've gone over this or like thought about this in great detail. So possibly, I mean, in 10 years time, I will be so much more used to being online than I already even am. So like quite possibly, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But right now I'm nervous.
Well, so Daniel Conroy Beam, what stood out to me most in thinking about whether a simulation could be really predictive of the kinds of couples that would thrive and succeed and last and be happy versus those that would not, I thought this works if people are static. But people are not static, and people are changing, and people's expectations are changing, and their hopes are changing. And I hope we're all working on ourselves. I hope we're all, you know, aware of our own flaws, and working on those, and maybe getting better at working through those. Or, you know, so I just feel like, how do you do this, knowing that what you are trying to match up is something that is changing, Daniel?
It's a great question, and that's something that we are very actively grappling with, because you're absolutely right. Right now, we're sort of getting people at a snapshot in time and trying to sort of reproduce a particular snapshot. But of course, you know, life is a moving picture, right? So we do have to be able to account for the ways in which people grow over time. And I think that's challenging, but I don't think it's impossible. And we are just starting, you know, we're in year two of a 5-year grant from the National Science Foundation, right? So this is still very much ongoing, but we literally just started, got the ball rolling on a new project where we're going to be doing a longitudinal study. We're going to be following up with people over the course of a year and trying to see, you know, how well can we build simulations that account for the changes in people's relationships over that year. And what do we need to change in these simulations to be able to, well, one, you know, can these simulations actually, you know, predict into the future how these relationships are going to develop? And two, you know, to the extent that they're not, how do we need to accommodate the ways that people change? But I think, you know, the fact that people change, it makes the work harder, right? But it doesn't make it impossible, right? We just need to understand, you know, what are the particular ways in which people change? What are the things that spark those changes? And how can we model those contexts or those experiences? How can we model those psychological systems that underlie those changes? And then how can we incorporate that into our simulation so that we can anticipate and account for the ways in which people change?
Shadi, when you think of yourself 10 years ago versus now, how much have you changed?
So much. I'm a different person for sure in a lot of ways. Yeah, definitely a different woman.
Do you feel like that would make it more challenging to line up, you know, what kind of future partner you'd be? Or do you feel like, you know, you're at the point now where you're pretty well settled in some of your goals and needs in a partner?
Good question. I think that sometimes you meet somebody who surprises you, right? And there's things that you didn't know that you'd be open to that now you find interesting. So I like to imagine that I don't know it all and that there's something I couldn't have considered that could come along. And that makes life more interesting to me. I think that the things that are fluid that I've noticed from the past, I can certainly talk about those changes. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to, and, you know, maybe we have multiple avatars, you know, just one. But yeah, does that answer the question?
Yeah, I think so. And I think a couple of emails are going to help us also flesh out some of the challenges or at least some of the issues facing people who are single and trying to find partners. So Dana writes to say that the best way to meet somebody and to really know them is in person. It's hard to do that through a computer simulation because people will lie. The most important thing you can do is be upfront and honest right away about your deal breakers. For example, if you don't want kids, you ought to be saying that on the first date. That is from Dana. I kind of want all three of you to weigh in on this. Because Daniel Conroy Beam, it sounds to me like what Dana is saying is she wants to sort right away in person in the first date, which is admirable. But you're trying to do that so people don't even have to end up on a date with somebody who might be totally mismatched, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we're not saying, you know, the simulation says you're a match and so, you know, your marriage certificate gets issued,
yeah.
You know.
Right. Send away, the invitations, right? Like, out. There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you still have to meet, right? You still have to actually develop the relationship. You still have to date. You still have to have those experiences. You know, we just want to help people, you know, curate a pool of partners that are likely to be successful so that they, you know, aren't having to go on dates with people that they don't have any future with.
Okay. So you're not trying to do all the work for people. You just want them to have a better chance before they even get out the door.
And yeah,
I think that makes sense. So so what Dana is saying here is that you got to come out with your deal breakers on date number one. Nicole Run, do you agree with that? I mean, are there certain things that you would tell somebody on a first date? You know, whether it's kids or other religion, big stuff, first date?
I haven't usually. I've known people that have done that who have built very successful relationships on top of it, but I wouldn't do that because, I mean, I guess I also just kind of, I'm kind of open to anything and like things that like I would consider deal breakers. I've dated people that have definitely done all my deal breakers, you know? So like I can be open to, I don't really have any deal breakers that are 100%. So I wouldn't even bring that up yet.
Okay.
I would see how things go.
Shadi, first date, how do you feel about Dana's law saying you got to put the deal breakers on the table at the first date?
I'm a pretty direct person and pretty honest, and I don't think it's wrong to put them out there. I don't think it's right or wrong. I think it depends, like, the context. If it sort of naturally comes out in the conversation, you know, the guy's, like, smoking a cigarette, or like he's got an alcohol problem. Like, if something comes out naturally and you connect on that level that you can feel comfortable to talk about it, then cool. And then you never know, people might be working on something, or it might spark the conversation to where they can say, okay, well, you know, I'm working on this, or I'm growing on this area. And it's okay to then, for me, my personality, I might say, okay, well, I'll be flexible if you're working on this thing, So I don't think you should shy away, because it could turn into a solution oriented compromising conversation mm-hmm. that you can live with.
Yeah. And it's also like, I think it's a question of how you even bring stuff up. I mean, like, if you're sitting at dinner with somebody on a first date and you pull out a notepad and you're like, all right, so let's talk kids. Like,
this is
going nowhere. This is really,
exactly.
Careful. You do not need Daniel Conroy Beam to tell you that that's going to fail. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. But I've had people like ask questions, if it just comes up and you feel comfortable, and sometimes serious things come up on a first date, you don't have to push it or force it, but you don't have to avoid it either.
Okay. Let me grab some more feedback. This is Keith in Victor. Hi, Keith.
Kevin, how are you doing?
Good, sir.
Interesting show, but I don't think it can be done. There's too many variables. Let's say you meet somebody and you both don't want children, but 5 years down the road, one partner changes their mind. There's just way too many variables. I mean, a relationship is like an oak tree. It starts out as a sapling, and the longer the relationship lasts, the stronger the oak tree becomes. But you're always... something could go wrong. I mean, to be able to predict it with any level of accuracy other than random chance, I think is a lot asking.
Well, okay.
But that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Keith. And in many ways, I agree. But I'll just say two things in defense of Daniel Conroy Beam and his work here. As much as we keep saying Black Mirror would be if he's saying, I've got the simulation that'll tell you whether to break up with your current partner because you've got no chance, or, here's five people, choose one and start planning a wedding that you've never met before. That would be weird stuff. But he would also open himself up for some serious lawsuits. I think in this case, he's just trying to help people get off the ground better. And Daniel, I mean, the truth is, Dan, our relationship record in this country is not very good. We've got a pretty high divorce rate. And there's and that failed relationships cause a lot of pain. So, I mean, I think the purpose of the research is pretty noble, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, thank you. And I mean, also for my part, I'd say we've got the data. Like, we're already way beyond chance. Chance is so far in the rearview mirror. So it's not a question of whether it can be done. I think at this point, it's a question of how good can we make it.
And Charles is saying, a few years back, the dating app Bumble banned hunting photos on user profiles claiming, quote, guns have no place in healthy relationships. Let's suppose the services being proposed take a similar discriminatory attitude. How accurate of matches can these services generate if their users are required to hide things about themselves in order to use the service? This is actually a bigger question than just about what Dan's research is doing. This is about whether you show up in person for a date and the person just doesn't look like their profile, or they are so different than the way they presented. Just briefly, Nicole, how often has that happened? They're very different in some way, and that you felt they misrepresented.
Not actually that often.
Oh, good.
I would say, like, I'm pretty good at figuring out. I think I have good luck, I guess. So the only thing is, in person, they're just a little bit more, like, you're less compatible conversationally. You find that out off the bat, but that risk is kind of known.
Sure. So, yeah. Shani, what about you? Any misrepresentation issues that you found?
No, people do come alive in conversation and are definitely different than text messaging. That's why I like to say, hey, why don't we jump on the phone for a few minutes and plan our first date? And that way you can get a sense of their communication on the phone a little bit. And then I've had people are like, well, I don't talk on the phone. And I'm like, well, we're not going on a date then. So, I've weeded out people that way. But when I have finally met with people, besides like looking slightly different than their pictures,
You know, you've got your best pictures up there.
It's not too bad.
No, I wouldn't say. Yeah. It's not too bad.
Okay.
No.
I'm so happy that Shadi and Nicole has absolved humanity, mostly men, of all of the lies I thought we were telling. But Daniel, let's wrap with this, Daniel. You are relying on people to be honest, and people are trying to put their best selves forward. How reliable are people going to be with this for you?
You know, people do try to put their best foot forward, right? And everybody, you know, tries to make themselves look, you know, maybe 10% better than they really are. But it's not as big an issue as people are worried about. I think for a lot of the reasons that were just raised, right? It's hard to lie authentically, right? You can find liars pretty quickly. You can't tell a big lie, right? If I say I'm 6'5 and I'm 5'5, I'm going to get found out, right? So lies are small.
But if you say all I care about is like humanitarian work and really what you want to do is binge watch TV 6 days a week, I mean, like, you could lie about that, and that's going to be trouble. But it seems like you're saying, you know, that's built in. It's part of the deal. Hopefully people won't lie.
Exactly, yeah.
Daniel Conroy Beam has been nice enough to explain this to us, and I hope you'll stay in touch. Good luck to you, Dan, and thank you for the work that you're doing. It's very interesting stuff.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks so much for having me.
He's head of the Computational Mate Choice Lab at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Shadi Kafi, I know we'll talk again soon. Good luck to you.
Thank you for having me, Evan. I've enjoyed this so much.
And Nicole Ron, same. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Evan.
Awesome. More connections coming up.